worst week, it seems, for the Dow and the S&P 500 since January of 2016.
What a day. It was a gut-clenching ride.
Investors turning tail in this final hour of trades, and all it took was about five different storms to create the tornado that we're seeing right now on Wall Street.
Three issues have the markets rattled. Rising rates are far and away the most important issue, but there's also some political risk, and today a little bit of earnings disappointments.
What we saw today in the past couple days is what is good news for the market is actually bad news.
No question, there's a calm about this sort of pullback here. I think more of a buyer strike than anything.
I think this is tough to do. You check your emotions. You look at the underlying economy.
Overall, the traders are comfortable with what they've seen. They're okay with a little bit of a pullback like this one. They even say they'll buy them next week.
Well, I think the markets are just going through this sort of angst. The underlying economy is still rock solid.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Volatility spikes on this Friday and stock prices plunge for not having more than a 2% correction in a year. Well, we got a mid-correction this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Big movement in the markets today. Of course, we're going to talk about that in this week's show, but my technician this week will be Jeff DeGraff, joining us from Renaissance Macro. He's here and saying that there is a long-term trend that is in place here, and he sees nothing that's going to reverse it, despite the events taking place this week in the market. But the big story was the rise in interest rates, which Ryan Poplava will be here to comment on, as interest rates spike across the board, as we have 30-year treasuries over 3%, and we have 10-year treasuries almost near 3%. And then later on in the program, we will have John Eng from Maison Placement as we talk about the gold market, the scarcity of gold, the greater demand and less supply going forward, and why John thinks the ultimate next stop for gold eventually will be $2,200. You're going to want to hear his reasons why. All of that coming up in Hour 1 this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. Coming up in the second hour of the program on The Big Picture, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava, who is Chief Investment Strategist for Financial Sense Wealth Management, will have a candid conversation on the outlook for stocks and stock investing in the coming year. And that will be our big picture today right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And welcome back, Ryan Poplava. It's time to talk about the action in the financial markets this week. It was sort of interesting toward the end of the week, wasn't it? It appears almost all asset classes, boy, took it on the chin with the S&P 500 down 3.86%, the Dow Industrials down 4.12%, and NASDAQ down 3.53%. Treasuries fell as yields rose. Crude, natural gas, and gold all fell this week. And profit taking didn't just take place in the U.S. either. The London Financial Times Index was down 1%. The Tokyo Nikkei was down 0.6%, and the Shanghai Stock Composite fell 3.12%. Well, it was bound to happen. I mean, most of the stock indices have been in uninterrupted trends. So now the question is, what do you think led to the correction? Was it merely a tired advance, or were there political events involved as well?
I think you're right on the former there, John, that it was just a tired advance in the sense that we've just been uninterrupted, like you said. You know, the week was packed with news, including a slew of technology earnings announcements, a lot of tech companies, Alphabet, underwhelmed and missed, but many others did outperform on their surprises, both on earnings and revenues. There was an FOMC meeting, so Federal Open Market Committee left things the same, no change in interest rates, which means that March is really going to be in focus, and the probability of there being a rate hike in March just went up. And then there was the President's State of the Union address, which he tackled a number of things. He said, you know, pharmaceutical drugs, he wants to help bring prices down there. And then an immigration bill he thinks should be in the future. He also announced that he wants Congress to do a $1.5 trillion stimulus plan for infrastructure. So there was a lot to talk about this week. The jobs report and other important economic data points all of this in a very big week. But if you ask me, John, which one of these did it? It's not a one. You know, it's a combination of we've gone too far, a little too fast. We're up like 7% this month. Too much of a good thing. And then there's the rising 10-year treasury yield. That all combined in turning what you may want to call the release valve here just open this week, where finally had some profit taking. There was a large swath of companies that beat earnings. As I mentioned, many even upgraded their guidance, and they closed many of these when they upgraded their guidance, still closed negative on their announcement days. And that means that investors think it's time, as I said, to just release that valve a little bit, take some profits. Yes, we expect earnings to be up this year. Yes, we expect sales to be up this year. But a lot of that, you could say, may be priced in, given that we knew at the end of last year that the tax bill was going to help corporate earnings. And when you look at the yield on the S&P 500, let's just talk about that 10-year treasury yield and the S&P 500 index yield. The S&P 500 is yielding around 1.76%, John. And if you look at the 2-year treasury, now 2.15% as of Friday midday when I last looked at it. So low interest rates were part of the financial repression strategy. It pushed investors out into riskier investments. Now, investors have to make some real allocation judgment calls here that weren't as easy to do now, but very much was easy back when interest rates were near zero. You know, where do you want to be invested? Where are you going to find that income? Well, it's in a dividend yield, not in debt.
Well, how does the average investor's allocation look like today in stocks, bonds, and cash?
That's a very good point and great question, because if everyone's allocated to stocks, how much more can they go up? Or if everyone's allocated towards bonds, then the other two choices look better. We've seen some research that shows equity allocations are near their 2015 peak and higher than the financial crisis peak. So there's a lot of emphasis, a lot of bullishness in equities valuations and in allocations there. Cash allocations are at the lowest they've been in 2 decades. And the same can be said for debt allocations. They're the lowest they've been in 2 decades. So from a percentage standpoint, where's the investor putting their money? It's mainly in equities. And those other areas, you know, when you tend to look at when everyone's pricing in the expectations, that's when the contrarian thing could happen. If we look at where people are putting their money, it's the reflation trade. That appears to be the primary driver in recent allocations towards different areas in stocks. So the largest percent has been going into materials, energy, financials, and tips, and away from some investments that typically underperform in a rising rate environment, like real estate investment trusts, utilities, etc.
Okay, I've got a question here, Ryan. You know, you said this week it was a good week in earnings, and it does seem the season so far has really produced some good results. So here's my question. Why aren't we seeing stocks lifted? Is it because prices already have priced in the optimistic view towards earnings this year because of the tax bill?
Yes. You know, earnings continue to be spectacular, John. If you look at just a breakdown of the market is right now rewarding positive earnings surprises less than average. So in earlier earnings seasons, when we've had positive surprises and upwards increases in guidance, the market rewarded that. They're doing it less so right now. But it's also interesting, if you look at the negative surprises, those investments are being hurt less than average typically. So it's interesting. I think optimism has been priced in. If you look at out of the 251 companies that have reported thus far, so basically half the S&P, 80% have beaten on sales estimates. About 75% have beaten on earnings estimates. The number of companies reporting on sales surprises, that's record setting, John. You know, 80% beating, it's a record. If you look at the last 5 years, the average is right around 56%. So the fact that 80% of companies reporting are beating on sales, something that they can't engineer, right? All their efforts in marketing and their sales force, that's their primary, and you know, selling a good product or a new product, that's how they're beating sales, not, you know, moving money around on the accounting statement. So the number of companies reporting sales surprises, like I said, it's just record setting. The materials sector has had the largest upside surprise from estimates, it's right around 11%, where interestingly, energy has had the largest downside difference between their actual earnings and where estimates were. Their spread is right around 12%. So the last report I read from FactSet, just looking at the earnings season in general, what's going on right now, the fourth quarter earnings right now estimates are for growth in the S&P up 13.4%. That's up from where estimates were at the end of last year at around 11%. So through this earnings season, there's been a lot of optimism and things have been adjusted for that. The final thing to say here on earnings, John, is that for all of 2018, analysts are projecting earnings growth of around almost 17%. And that's up from the beginning of this year where analysts were estimating around 12% for the year. So constantly, I mentioned it last week and the week before, when we're listening to these earnings conferences, companies are increasing their guidance this year. And their primary reason for that they're focusing on is the tax bill.
Yeah, okay, and that's obviously understandable. Now, you did mention a number of events this week earlier, so why don't you give us a summary of some of what you see to be the important catalysts which affected the market this week, and just do a wrap-up for the week.
Sure. Earnings were a big deal. We just went through that. The FOMC meeting, the policy statement came as expected, with a balanced economic outlook, an eye towards inflation, given it's below target still, and then essentially further gradual adjustments to rates higher in the near future. So in December, we looked at the dot plot, which was all the members highlighting where they think rates will be at the end of this year. They all pretty much average around 3 rate hikes. So we're pretty much in tune there. The key ticket is that the meeting increased the chances, like I said earlier already, for a March increase, with the probability going up from, it was 74% going into the meeting, 83% coming out for a quarter point in March. Now, let's talk about some of the other events this week. That was an important one. Didn't really have a huge effect. Did on interest rates and currencies. But looking at the State of Union address by Trump, he called for Congress to pass a $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan, which, wow, you know, we had the tax bill. It's unprecedented to get this kind of fiscal stimulus at the end of a business cycle. We're pretty long in the tooth on this. Yes, we're still growing at a 3% rate back in the second quarter and the third quarter. Q4 was a little under, and that was just the first estimate. But, you know, now he's saying an infrastructure plan. Typically, these things happen when the market's down and the economy is down to help stimulate and bring things back. So very unprecedented. And it has the implications really of essentially increasing the growth and extending this business cycle, as well as possibly some inflationary implications, as we've been starting to see in some of those wage reports since early January. Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan Chase announced this week that they plan to form a company focused on reducing healthcare costs for their U.S. employees. Many of our listeners have probably already heard that, but it has some long-standing implications for the industry. And there's that thing that we call the Amazon effect, right? They purchased Whole Foods last year. We saw an immediate effect on grocers, and a lot of those stock prices, you know, capitulated over a short period of time, and many have come back. You look at Costco, it's up well above where it was after that Amazon effect. But we essentially had that this week, right? The healthcare stocks just capitulated in midweek when we heard this news, and so did some of the insurance carriers as well. The Health Transformation Alliance, not many people know what that is or even have heard of it. It's a group of 46 large employers who essentially tried to band together to reduce prices about 2 years ago. They did it. They were successful in renegotiating about a 15% reduction in their costs with CVS Health Corp and United Health. So essentially, Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan, they're trying to do the same thing for their employers. It stands to, I think, for the most part, help. You know, this is capitalism trying to adjust what, you know, the government hasn't been able to do.
Yeah, exactly. And it should be interesting to see where it goes, because there has been an Amazon-like effect in grocers since the purchase of Whole Foods. But, and I mean, here's something else, though. Look at Costco. The stock price is actually higher since then. So these changes are slow to arrive, but, you know, it could be interesting to see if the hand of capitalism can do what the hand of government has not been able to do to reduce healthcare costs, the promises of politicians notwithstanding, shall we say.
Exactly.
That's the best way I can put it. Finally, Ryan, what can you tell us about the economic front this week?
Well, just real quickly, there was a lot to go through, and we could be here another 10 minutes. But essentially, the jobs report came out, an increase of about 200,000 in January, which was above estimates. Average hourly wages increased by 0.3%. Again, that's the one thing we continue to focus on here, is that we're starting to finally see wage inflation. And it's not runaway inflation. It's just getting started. But it is happening and it could have some effects long term. Will it cause the Fed to be more aggressive? It's way too early to say that, but it's something to continue to watch. Manufacturing continues to hum along, John, in expansionary territory, but we did see deceleration slightly. The January ISM index fell down to 59.1 from 59.3 in December. Anything above 50 is expansionary, so we say decelerated ever so slightly. Factory orders were up 1.7% in December. That's a hard number, while November was actually revised higher. So no slowdown in orders or manufacturing heading into the year end per usual. So a very strong end for the year and has great implications for the first quarter this year. Personal income rose 0.4% and so did spending 0.4% in December. The price index component, when we were looking at that, was up only 0.1% in December, which puts the year-over-year core PCE price index, this is what the Fed looks at very hard, it was only up 1.5% for 2017. That's still very much below the Fed target of 2% for inflation. So a lot of room for the Fed to continue to be very gradual, and we're going to continue to see that this year unless those numbers increase at a rapid pace. Personal savings rate dropped, highlighting basically consumers are confident. And on that note, consumer confidence came out this week. Also, I think the Michigan sentiment indicator, the consumer confidence rose to 125.4 from 124 in January. So essentially the takeaway there is consumers are feeling confident about their jobs and income. Finally, housing. Some numbers there. Case-Shiller index up 6.4% in November. That's a soft number. Pending home sales, hard number, increased 0.5% in December. So, John, economy is just firing on all cylinders. No complaints there. When we're looking at a correction like this, this is merely a tactical one, a technical one, in which, like I said, that release valve is being released a little bit from valuations. But still very optimistic on the economy, very optimistic on corporate earnings. And wow, if we get another $1.5 trillion fiscal stimulus, we're definitely, I think, going to be looking at inflationary issues down the road.
Yeah. You can see that one coming. Of course, on the other hand, you can't argue that the economy is doing good things and the number of jobs that people are getting are going up. I mean, real world jobs, it's actually happening. And tax cuts and people getting bonuses and things like that as a result of that. So anyway, we always end by saying, wow, this should be an interesting year. And it always turns out to be. So I guess that's a good prediction to make. But I really appreciate it, Ryan Poplava. I want to see where things are going to go politically over the next week and see how that affects the markets.
Yeah, certainly. We had the State of Union address. There was a lot to digest there from that. And let's see what happens politically. Is he able to do what he wants to do? Who knows?
Yep, I agree with it. Okay, Ryan, see you again next week.
Talk to you later.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining me on the program from GabCal Research is Anatole Galecki. And Anatole, I want to begin with something that you wrote late last year, Goldilocks and the 10 Grizzly Bears. You were talking about possible reasons or causes that could bring this bull market and economy to a standstill or even a recession.
Right. Well, Jim, before I answer that question, I feel that it's important to put what we're about to talk of the risks to the cycle and the bull market in a very specific context. That context is that I have been what you might call a perma bull about both the global economic expansion and the bull market in equities for much of the period since the financial crisis, particularly for the last 4 or 5 years. Now, until last summer, when I was going around the world talking to clients and investors, I got a tremendous amount of resistance to the idea that this could continue for a long time, and that it wasn't just a dead cat bounce after the extreme crisis of 2008-09. And as I say, you know, I was bullish throughout that period. In the last 6 months, especially I'd say since the middle of the fall, I found talking to clients, there's no longer any pushback, and everybody says, of course this is a bull market, of course this is a global expansion, and of course it'll go on for a long time ahead. Now, I still believe that the most likely scenario is that it will go ahead, that it will go on at least the next few years, and I don't think the cycle is yet dying of old age, even in the U.S. But I do think that the bullish, the positive consensus is now so strong, which it wasn't as much as 6 months ago, that we have to start thinking very seriously about what the potential risks are.
Well, the stock market seems to be unstoppable. Ever since the election, it looks like an elevator ride on the way up. Recently, we've had a pullback. Is this the beginning of something more serious, and should investors be aware? Joining me on the program from Renaissance Macro is Jeff DeGraff. He's ranked number one technical analyst by Institutional Investor Magazine. Jeff, welcome to the show. And as you view the markets from your perch, what does it look like?
Well, I think there's a couple things that stand out. And the first that we hear a lot of is this market is overbought, it's overbought, therefore sort of the de facto position is that it must be bearish. And, you know, in fact, if you go back and look at these extreme overbought conditions, which this is certainly one of a handful that we've seen since 1929, if you use a 14-week RSI or oscillator, and you do the work on it, this is the most extreme that we've had since 1995. And again, there were a handful of times before that. And each one of those actually produced well above average returns out the next 12 months. So, you know, are we stretched and were we on an unsustainable pace for the month of January? Absolutely. Does it portend a weak 2018? We would say absolutely not, but a consolidation or a digestion period that then moves higher towards the back half of the first half of the year, we think certainly that is most likely in the cards. And I would say that because despite rates going up, the credit conditions as we follow them are still very, very ample in terms of the amount of credit that's being provided to the system. And we would actually make the case that, and we made this case back in August, that we think the market is actually poised for a melt up. And, you know, within that context, while the inflation numbers might not show it, the ample credit sort of finds its way into financial assets, and that's where you get the inflation. You don't get it in the Starbucks coffee or, you know, the price of McDonald's or even, you know, your clothing. You get it in financial assets, and we think that that's probably the biggest risk in the markets today.
So as you look at this market and you say the conditions are there for a melt up, typically when you see something as we do today where stocks, it just seems like they've been unstoppable. Is this supported, Jeff, not only by the credit conditions you see, but also by a change in sentiment? In other words, a lot of individual investors have been on the sidelines. This has been mainly institutional driven in many ways. Does sentiment change and support that melt up? In other words, the little guy finally says, hey, look what's happening in the stock market. I need to get in.
Well, I think that's right. And it also tends to be at the tail end something that's momentum based and that certainly favors indexing. And, you know, one of the arguments that we make is that indexing really is, and one of the reasons why it's so difficult to beat the index is it's a quasi momentum strategy, right? There are very few portfolio managers that as the value of something goes up, you're buying more and more of it. And that's exactly what an index strategy does. As the capitalization of a company becomes bigger, in other words, as its weight becomes bigger, you're forced to buy actually more and more of that particular name. So it does become a momentum strategy. And what's interesting is as we look at momentum strategies historically and how those have played out, we're not anywhere near some of those extremes that you generally get towards the very tail end of an advance. So I think there's still more of this migration, if you will, towards indexing that will take place and push these things further and further as we go. I'd actually add one thing to that. You know, people talk about the Cape and some of these questionable indications of value and how things are stretched. We've done a lot of work on valuation, and you can see one of our valuation measures in the slides we provided. But when we take value, and by far the single best factor for individual companies on average, not for every single company, but on average, the best is EBITDA to enterprise value. If you look at that and you compare that to BBB yields through time, that's a very effective valuation indicator. And so if you don't do that, you really get biased by the 1970s or early 1980s when rates were extraordinarily high. If you look at valuation today and you adjust it for credit, or specifically the cost of corporate credit, valuation is actually exactly where you'd expect it to be over the long run. So in our view, valuation even has further to go, presuming that credit stays relatively stable here, that you could actually extend this even further without having that weight of valuation on your shoulders.
So as you look at this, and we have a phenomenon that you just touched upon, and that is index funds, because when money comes into an index, it doesn't matter what the value of Amazon is, Google, or any Alphabet, any of those stocks. The index manager simply buys the stocks according to the weight of the index. The market cap increases, which means more money goes into those stocks. I want to touch upon not only indexing, Jeff, but also the impact of algorithmic trading in this market, because some have commented that the VIX has never been this low. But how much of that is a phenomenon of algorithms in the marketplace, because computers don't have emotions like you and I as humans?
Yeah, I certainly think that there's been a change in the dynamic, and part of that is through algorithmic trading. Volatility is also a byproduct of credit conditions. And so when credit conditions are extraordinarily easy, you tend to have low volatility environment. You know, the last time we had volatility that was on average about where we are today was back in the mid-aughts, you know, in 05 and 06. When, you know, again, liquidity through the mortgage and the asset-backed markets was just, you know, more than ample at the time, created a relatively low volatility environment. But, you know, the difference today is, as you say, algorithmic trading and certainly taking slices. And I think the compression in terms of cost per share to execute also makes it easier to transact a little bit more with less impact on the overall portfolio. So I think all those things are part of this dynamic that we're seeing.
I want to move on to some things that can even make this more favorable. We just got this tax cut. Obviously, when you reduce tax rates from 35% to 21%, that's favorable. We've also had a downward trend in the dollar, which I'd like you to touch upon, because so many of the S&P 500 companies are international companies. And of course, the dollar going down, that helps earnings. So I wonder if you'd comment on not only the tax cuts, but also the dollar and the impact that might have on earnings going forward.
Yeah, the one surprising thing with the tax cuts is we haven't seen it really resonate in the small cap area as much as we'd expect to see versus the large cap. But at the same time, it's hard to distinguish or break that out because we have had that decrease in the dollar, as you mentioned, and certainly that's more favorable to the large cap companies. So yeah, both of those things are certainly tailwinds. They are facing off against the headwind of higher rates. But if you look historically, the larger impact in terms of the delta or the change from a month to month or quarter to quarter basis, this comes not so much from yields, but does come from the dollar as it impacts earnings. So, you know, the tax cut, as we see it, was really a surprise. I mean, most analysts were at best 50-50 on the administration being able to get something done, particularly before the end of the year. And so you really started to see it, and we have it in sort of our earnings surprises and estimates that you can see. Most of these things have moved themselves in the top decile. In other words, analysts were very quickly ratcheting up their earnings estimates because they were woefully pessimistic on something getting done and then had to readjust that. So, you know, part of that is obviously the strength that we've had in the last 2 months is based on that. And I think that's also partly what you've seen in this migration from tech being so dominant in most of 2017 to being less dominant in the very back half of 2017. And a little more broadly speaking, you know, seeing improvements in healthcare, seeing improvements in discretionary and some of these other areas that are bigger beneficiaries of the tax cut and, frankly, at least equal beneficiaries in terms of a weaker dollar.
I want to talk about something that may, and let's say we do go through this melt up with earnings and all the favorability that is built in this market right now. I want to talk about something that may cause trouble down the road. We've seen a backup in yields, especially on the 10-year. Some are saying that we could approach 3% or go beyond. But in your recent work, you're showing that global yields have not broken out. So let's talk about interest rates, the Fed, and what that might mean for the market going forward.
Well, I do think that you've got generally higher rates that you have to be prepared for. You know, two things are important. One is the yield curve itself, and people will make a big fuss about how wide that spread is between tens and twos. There really isn't much consistency there. It's really more of a binary prospect. In other words, if the curve is inverted, it's bearish. If it's not inverted, things tend to be fine, and you don't have to worry about how big that spread is, just as long as there's a positive spread there. And that's still positive. The other thing that we look at is the difference between the Fed fund and the two-year yield. That's really the subsidized price of money, which is from the Fed, and the market price of money, which is the two-year yield. That's over 50 basis points here. And what that's saying is that the market is telling you, or telling the Fed at least, that it can withstand higher rates without really choking this thing off. And I think that's an important part of the equation. The other thing that I think is not understood is back in the early 2000s, for whatever reason, Bernanke thought it was the global savings glut. Some people have other ideas, but back in the early 2000s, 2001 to be specific, there was a regime change. And what I mean by that is, you know, the first half of my career and all my schooling was interest rates go down, stocks go up, interest rates go up, stocks go down. And that actually shifted in the early 2000s in a statistically meaningful way, where we can actually say today that with some certainty, more than just randomly, when yields go up, stocks go up. When yields go down, stocks go down. And so the higher yields, as much as that may seem counterintuitive, are actually still beneficial to equities, presuming that they stay within some sort of boundary. Our best guess around that when we do the high-level math is something close to 3.5%. Obviously, there's a pretty big error band around that, but I think it's well above 3% before that actually starts to impact equities negatively. So I wouldn't be too concerned about rising rates. They tend to portend a better global situation or scenario for the economy. And unless you invert the curve, unless you take, say, the marginal credits of, say, double B versus triple B spreads and start to see those widen, we still think that the conditions from an interest rate perspective will remain favorable for stocks.
I want to talk about something you had in your latest chart pack, a review of the 1987 crash. Some are saying that if we do get a melt-up, as you think is very possible, at least in the first half, if we get that melt-up, is it possible out of the blue with rising rates that we could get something that all of a sudden spooks the market and we get a huge sell-off like we did in 87 or maybe like the flash crash in 2010?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this long enough that you always keep the possibilities of anything open, right? But the reason we put the 1987 scenario in was because we heard a lot of chatter about, you know, rates rising was the final sort of straw that broke the camel's back. Some people said it was oil. Others said it was a weak dollar. And if you looked at those trends, and we have it in the piece, but if you look at those trends over, you know, the previous year to 2 years, these were not shocks to the system. These were not suddenly up and then down or suddenly down and then up. They were basically persistent trends, and yields were probably the most dramatic that from the beginning of 1987 till the crash, you took yields from roughly 7% up to just under 10%. So that was, you know, not quite a 50% increase in terms of the 10-year yield. But the point there was that they had been moving up for an extended period of time. It wasn't something that had just suddenly some dislocation in the bond market. It was something that was actually building. And I would also say that in 1987, you had some divergences in terms of momentum and some other things that had developed, particularly in the latter part of 87, that were inconsistent with a strong or healthy internal market. And that's just not where we are today. Most of the things that we see internally for the market are still quite favorable for a continuation in equities. Now, what I would say is 1987, one of the ways that we define a melt-up in 1987 certainly did qualify, is that the market is up 50% or more over the previous 18-month period. And so that would put us roughly at 3,400 on the S&P towards the end of June of this year. or close to 3,600 by the end of the year. So it gives you some perspective as to what would qualify as a melt-up. And certainly if we saw rates and as we look at it, credit conditions deteriorate as the market moves ever and ever higher, that would be of some concern. But we just don't see it. In fact, our credit condition model is two standard deviations above the norm that we usually expect to see at any given point in time. And obviously, that's more supportive for equities than not.
I want to talk about something else that you point out, and you normally see this towards the end of a business cycle. As inflation starts to pick up, the economy starts to grow at a faster pace as we're doing now, and that is commodities. You have a chart. Commodities are looking more attractive. Explain what you see there, and what is it? Would it be base metals? Is it across the whole sector? Is it oil, gold?
Yeah, so we use the commodity index in the chart that you're referencing, and basically what we're looking at is the performance of commodities or the commodity index as it relates to the S&P over an extended period of time, back 50, almost 60 years. And the idea here, the concept, is really we're measuring what's known as alpha. It's the excess return that you receive per unit of risk. And we do something special mathematically where we standardize that through time. The point here is that you shouldn't expect to receive persistently positive or negative alpha in any asset class. If that existed, then there's something wrong with capital markets because you could just simply own one asset class, short the other, and forever, you know, forever play that into perpetuity and obviously become very wealthy in doing so. So by definition, that alpha must mean revert. And the point that we're making here is that the commodities as they relate, the alpha in commodities as it relates to the alpha in the S&P has been woefully negative. And that is a combination of energy and industrial metals and precious metals. And it's now started to turn marginally higher. And so we think as you look out the next 3 to 5 years, the prospects of commodities as they relate to financial assets are probably at least equal, if not maybe a little better. Now, we haven't seen an actual improvement in the relative performance of these commodities. So that's sort of the one linchpin that we'd wait for from a timing perspective to become more aggressive. But, you know, certainly as we sniff around energy and particularly the industrial metals, there is an attractiveness there. The Freeport-McMoRan's of the world certainly look very interesting from a long-term perspective, and the supply-demand dynamics there look very interesting as you know, take it out 5 years plus. To answer your question more specifically, you know, our rank order would be first, it would be industrial metals, second, it would be the precious metals, and then third, it would be energy. We do think, and this is one of the reasons why we think there's the high possibility of a melt-up, is that we do think that there has been, with the advent of fracking and the shale boom, this more elastic supply curve that's developed. In other words, you're able to supply the oil markets more easily and more quickly than you have in the past, and therefore you can respond to price more quickly. If that's true, and most of our work would suggest it is just the way the prices are acting, then the ability of oil to rise dramatically and choke off the economy or the strength of the economy is less than it was, say, 10 years ago or 20 or 30 years ago particularly. And if that's the case, such a big part of the inflation impact flows through oil that the Fed may be keeping an eye on the inflation data, which is not responding as aggressively as might otherwise be because of this elasticity in the supply of oil, and therefore keeping the inflation data lower than it might otherwise, and the Fed looser than they might otherwise, and again, providing sort of the fuel, if you will, for a melt-up or that inflation finding its way into asset prices.
You know, Jeff, you've been rated one of the top technical analysts in the country for the last 11 years by Institutional Magazine. As a technician, you know, everybody has a favorite tool. Is there something that you watch or a tool that you use that has been very predictable or reliable for you in your trade?
Well, you know, we're known as technicians. I think we bring a lot of things into the fold. We always start with price. So, you know, I would always defer to price. The market collectively tends to be much brighter and astute on average than any individual. So we certainly pay attention to what the message of the market is. We've always been good at understanding the relationship in the credit markets and how they impact equities, sometimes favorably, sometimes disfavorably. And we still do rely on that. And a lot of the work that we do is intra-market. In other words, the combination of not only economic data, but of currencies and of commodities and, as we said, credit. And it's that combination, I think, that gives us a very unique perspective. You know, the one thing I would say, and I always tell people, to get a true global sense of what's going on, I don't know how anybody else does it without using charts. You know, I can sit down on the weekends at my home office and go through, you know, the charts of the world relatively quickly, call it within a half hour to 45 minutes, and get a pretty good understanding as to what's happening. You know, to do the same analysis fundamentally would be literally impossible. It would take, you know, weeks and months, and then having to redigest the data as it comes out. And, you know, one of the philosophies that we live by here, because not only have we proven it to be true, but it certainly has helped us in our careers over the last 30 years, is that price tends to lead data. And that's why this business is so difficult, because if it were the other way around, it would be easy, right? Employment goes up and, you know, the stocks follow. Well, generally the market's already anticipating these things. And so, you know, really listening to the message of the market is critical. And certainly we'd encourage everybody, even if you're not an expert technician, just become familiar with charts, familiar with trend, you know, understand that these things tend to persist, just like the fundamentals do. Fundamentals don't jump around on a daily basis or quarterly basis. They tend to persist over time, and the price trends do too.
Well, Jeff, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, would you give out your website and tell them how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, it's www.renmac, R-E-N, as in November, M as in Mike, AC.com, renmac.com. And on there is a link to get in touch with either someone from sales or research, where they can start receiving not only our work, but the work of Neil Dutta, who does our economics work, and some of the fundamental analysts that we have employed as well.
I might want to point out, on our website, if you're listening to this broadcast, just go to our webpage, and we have a page there for a trial subscription to Jeff's letters. Jeff, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Great information. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Here's a reminder that if you're not listening to the Daily Financial Sense News Hour, you're really missing a lot. Let me show you.
The cost in dollars and cents of reading a stretch of DNA, reading the genetic code, has plummeted. If you're familiar with the idea of Moore's Law, this idea that a computer processor doubles its processing power every 2 years, that's true of DNA reading too. We've doubled our ability to read DNA every 2 years. And in fact, we are far outpacing Moore's Law. So we're reading DNA basically for free. And coupled to that, our ability to synthesize DNA is also getting better at a pretty incredible clip. So the scale at which we're doing these experiments is increasing year over year, which is leading to the really rapid growth of this field.
Well, like the rest of the market, asset classes have been going up this year, even though on this Friday we're going through a bit of a correction. One asset that has been doing well since early December is the price of gold. It's over 1,300, finally breaching that 1,300 level. Joining us on the program is John Eng from Maison Placement. John, let's talk about gold. We saw gold last year take off in the middle of the summer, got up to over that 1,300 level by the beginning of September, but then it was a downward swing into December. And here we are. We got back up to that 1,360 level, but gold has pulled back here a little bit. What is driving this? And is this just a dead cat bounce, or is there something more serious going on in the gold market?
Well, Jim, I think that what we are witnessing is the turnaround from a three-year base. The fact that gold broke up beyond 1325, you mentioned it ran into resistance at 1360, reversed that three-year base building. And my sense is that after this digestion of the move, my expectation is that we have $100, $200 move still to come. And the primary reason, of course, for the move in the gold price is the decline in the U.S. dollar. While we were all enjoying the daily market highs, the U.S. dollar was reaching lows. And in fact, it did touch a three-year low. Today, it's rallying, more of a dead cat bounce, as you say. But my sense is that the dollar has been under pressure while the stock market made new highs. Now, simply, my expectation is that, and explanation is that the market is making new highs because of the growth cult, the expectations that tax cuts, the aftermath of a series of quantitative easing, have put a lot of money into the system. And we are starting to see that money at work. Commodities went to three-year highs. The stock market, we saw there was an explosion in asset prices. And it was only a matter of time that there would be the realization that this period would ultimately end up in inflation. And that's what we are seeing, is the beginning of inflation. And of course, that's always good for gold. The other factor at work is that we saw these bubbles being series of bubbles. We saw the stock market bubble. We saw the crypto bubble. And the timing is such that in December, we saw the bust of the crypto. I think in January, we're seeing the bust in the U.S. dollar. The stock market, who knows, maybe in February. But against these bubbles, you get new bubbles that are being formed. The money is sort of sloshed around. And I think it's going into the commodities and the gold prices as a prime beneficiary. So my expectation is that when we look ahead, is that the ingredients for much higher gold prices are very much intact. We have still growth, which will reinforce with the tax cut. We have China, my gosh, that's growing at 6.9%, and they have been sopping up commodities. The super cycle seems to be in place in China again. And we have even, when you look at the former dead man lying down, Europe, which is actually last year, Europe outpaced the Dow Jones. So my expectation is that we got a bout of growth ahead, higher interest rates. We have a new Fed chairman. They are likely to pursue the very tepid pace followed by his predecessor, Yellen. So it's good for gold.
So some of the drivers, you talk about the dollar, inflation. Let's talk about rising interest rates, because that's one of the things that's been giving the stock market a little bit of a trouble. The 10-year has been breaking out. What is your view on interest rates and the price of gold?
Well, we saw this turnaround in gold at a time when you look last year, when we had three interest rate increases. In the 70s, we've had series of increases in interest rates, and gold still went up. Interest rates are still nominally very low. And yes, I expect a gradual tightening, but we know what would happen to the whole system and to the stock market bubble if interest rates went up by 2% or 200 basis points. That's unlikely to happen. We are to get interest rates to go up slowly, but I also think that growth will be a lot more faster given the monetary fuel that is still around.
So as you look at this market, and I want to talk about something longer term, the U.S. is expected to start running bigger deficits, whether it's the tax cuts or it's the baby boomers heading into retirement, putting strains on Social Security. Moody's just did a report recently on the state of the states, where municipalities are seeing large unfunded pension liabilities that are estimated to be, John, somewhere around $1.1 trillion, including my own state of California at the top of it. So as you look at these budgetary demands that are going to be coming forward, deficits are going to be growing. You have 70% of U.S. government is now going to Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt. And so down the road, you have to wonder, as these deficits begin to explode, and they're almost on automatic pilot because you don't see politicians cutting back on these benefits, what happens to the dollar? And will the Fed in the end be forced to basically print money to pay for that debt?
Well, I think that says it, and that's the solid underpinning for higher gold prices, Jim. There's no question that, in my mind, that the price of gold turnaround is based on the premise that deficits that we expect are going to be as high as the eye can see. We have not only the tax cut, but we also have potentially $1 trillion worth of infrastructure spending that's still to come. When I talk to our overseas clients, everybody is talking about, well, if this spending is going to continue where the Americans have spent a decade of quantitative easing, printing money, that monetary fuel is like putting oil on a fire. And we've been in previous period cycles when that's happened, and the dollar is the biggest casualty. And my expectation is the dollar the DXY broke down below that 90. It looks like it could go to 88, but between the 82 and 85 is where there's long-term support. That suggests to me that we would have much higher gold prices. Second factor at work is that a lower dollar, notwithstanding recent announcements by the administration, is also part and parcel of a way to get exports going. And we here in Canada know the impact of a weaker currency and what it means for exports, and we're on the other side of the equation. So my belief is that we have a very subtle currency war, and that is why I believe that the Chinese, that the Russians, that Germans have been buying, the Koreans have been buying gold, physical gold, with the expectation that the U.S. dollar is going lower. So that provides the primary underpinning to this price of gold.
So, you know, let's talk about gold and let's talk about China. China is a large gold producer, but John, as you know, much of the gold produced in China is consumed internally. In addition, China goes out into the world and purchases additional gold. So you've got this demand that's coming in from central banks and probably a lot of foreign investors. Let's talk about the other side of that equation, which is supply. You've got supply that has been diminishing as many of the large producers. I don't care if you're looking at Barrick, you're looking at Newmont. The large gold companies have seen declining production over the years. They haven't replaced it. And during the gold downturn, a lot of projects that were supposed to come on board, just like we saw with oil, have been shelved with CapEx spending put on hold. So how does the gold market respond to that? It seems to me it's going to be one of economics, higher prices.
Well, that's a very good point, Jim. I did a review of the declining reserves of the gold industry and looked at about 14, 15 of the big producers, and only less than a handful of them replaced their reserves last year. The dilemma for these gold producers is growth, and that, to me, is a big problem now that they redressed their balance sheets. When you look at the Chinese, which is the largest producer in the world, they produce something like 486 tons. They spent the last 10 years growing around 400 tons a year. Their demand is 3-4 times that. And so they go out into the free world, into the Western world, and have sopped up all that physical gold. The problem for the Chinese is that you look at their reserve positions, by the 2020-2021, a lot of their big mines will be out of reserves. So the world's biggest gold producer will not be the world's biggest gold producers in a few years. And so my expectation is that the Chinese are looking for alternatives. We've seen them take stakes in companies like Pretium or do deals with Barrick and that. And my expectation is they have the capital, whereas we look at our gold mines here. The dilemma is finding new reserves, and the reserves that they have on their books today are some big capital projects, such as Goldcorp's Cerro Casales is going to cost $3 to $4 billion to put into production. And that's a problem for the gold mining industry, is that when they look down the road, the capital required is going to be so large. So there's another underpinning for the higher gold prices.
So as you look at these large producers, they're not replenishing, their production is in decline. In the last decade, John, you saw the rise of junior mining companies. These were companies, speculative companies, raised capital, went out looking for projects to explore. That industry got decimated during the downturn. A lot of those companies disappeared. It's very hard for these companies to raise capital. Is there anything out there? Do you see this coming back, or is this going to be limited to just just a few companies, because how many juniors, or at least reputable juniors, are out there now doing the exploration work that a lot of these large companies depended on to buy and replace their reserves?
It's another good astute point, Jim, because the junior developers like BT Gold, McEwen, they've already garnered a fair amount of support, and thus they've been valued much higher in the last 12 months. But when you look at the exploration companies, there are few. The ones that were very popular last year, like Novo Resources in Australia, that was a shooting star, but unfortunately, it turned out to be a bust as the grades just were not supported with further drilling. We have Pretium, which is a project that took a few years to put in production, and it cost almost $1 billion to put in production. They had problems in the last quarter because their grade is in half. So the money for exploration has, even the majors have not been spending that money. So my sense is that when you look around, you have to look around for exploration companies with not old, tired gold mines that they want to reopen, but new areas. I think I mentioned in the past Orania, which we helped finance. This is run by Keith Barron, and who has among the largest land positions in Ecuador. He's been chasing for 10 years now to repeat his success. He actually found one of the richest deposits in Fruta del Norte, which is being put in production by Lucas Lundin, Lundin Gold, and that will be the world's one of the large producers coming on stream within a couple of years after spending about $500 million. Keith wants to replicate his success, and in doing so has secured 200,000 hectares, but the size of Rhode Island, of very, very promising ground along the Cordillera, which hosts multitudes of epithermal and porphyry deposits. This is grassroots. It's jungle, but already he's flown airborne. He sent 8 crews out looking for the signature rocks. And my expectation is that that's a story that I think over the next year, 2 years, as he searches for and look for that deposit, that I expect him to have another success. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of companies like Keith as far as the exploration side. There are some projects in areas like Nevada or Quebec, but none, in my opinion, with the blue sky potential. And that's what looks interesting to me.
Yeah. In fact, his company was just featured in Bloomberg. I guess they went out there and did a story on that. Let's talk about some of those areas. When you see something like what was found in Fruta del Norte by Aurelian, do you see, you know, most geological formations tend to be a long trend running, like the Carlin Trend in Nevada. This area in Ecuador and around there, that was a rich producing area for the Spanish Empire. So do these trends tend to be long, like what you see in Mexico, what you see in Nevada? So if that's the case, why aren't more companies in that area exploring? In other words, if you found, let's take the oil industry, you take these shale plays like the Permian Basin, where you find an area that is very rich in a resource, whether it's oil, whether it's gold, or whether it's copper, why aren't more companies exploring in that area?
Well, there's difficulty. In Ecuador, in particular, President Correa, who was there for 2 terms, he started his period of being very socialistic and anti-business, and was only in the last part of his term did he realize how opening up to mining, being pro-business, could reignite, revive his economy, and that's what's happened. And so his predecessor has, in fact, there's a referendum today, this weekend, supporting even more opening the doors. So the doors haven't been wide open for, and as Keith is one of the first movers there, So he has a first mover advantage. Other companies, Newmont, Newcrest, some of the biggies are now looking at Ecuador more favorably. But you're right that these deposits tend to be a string of deposits, almost like a string of pearls. And when you look at what Aurania has, their land position is to the north part of the country. And there's a heavily green area, heavily jungles. To the south, it was much, much more open, and that lent itself to surface exploration, that you could see rocks on the surface. It's Fruta del Norte itself had no surface showings. It was discovered through a lot of detective work by Keith and looking at rocks and then drilling. So my expectation is he's emulating the same type of success, looking for the rocks, flying the airborne, and that's a good way to find these deposits. Already, he's had a number of what they call hot spots, and he's narrowing down. And my expectation is they should at least get a dozen or so great targets in the mining game. You would only want one target, but he's going to have multiple targets. And so that's what makes it look exciting.
When you have something like that, you know, one thing that revitalized the energy industry in the U.S., John, was horizontal drilling and fracking. Is there anything like that that has come into the mining industry that enables you to find more gold, to get more gold out of the ground? Is there anything technologically that is going on that can enhance the mining industry? I know that, for example, Aurania recently used helicopters where they could go in, and I'm not sure what the technology is, but it gives them the ability to locate these hot spots. So is there any technology that's coming out in the mining industry that can enhance it?
Well, the geophysics is one of the best ways to cover a fairly large land position. Think of finding gold as if you had a loaf of raisin bread and you're looking for the raisins. It would be very difficult from the surface to be able to find all those little raisins in that loaf of bread. When you fly airborne, this gives you sort of the hot spots of what to look for. But you still have to do the ground searching for the signature rocks to support that. And Keith, an historian, has taken the historic leg, and he's also looking for where they previously mined gold when the Spaniards were around, and looking for what he calls the lost cities. And so that's a sort of a third leg to the search for the deposit. Drilling is fairly straightforward. The drilling is we now have the capability of drilling fairly deep underground, a couple miles. These deposits that Keith is looking for, I believe that these epithermals, he'll be able to do some scout drilling, and he will not have to necessarily drill that deep. And so he'll be able to drill off a lot of holes pretty quickly to get a pretty good idea of narrow down where these deposits lie.
So outside areas like Ecuador, which are rich in deposits, any other areas around the globe, or is the world pretty much mined out? I mean, South African production was a very rich area for gold mining, but a lot of those mines, John, they're going deep into the earth's surface to get at the remaining gold.
Well, I think that when you look at Latin America, there's Colombia. The key in Colombia is again, the politics. You could only mine under certain levels. One must be very environmentally conscious. Chile, Peru also hosts some terrific deposits. But again, the indigenous community, you have to be very cautious of. And so that's a big factor is the environment. The second area is Canada's north. A company called Agnico Eagle has been very successful, and Canada, like the United States, is very friendly to mining, but still one must be cognizant of the indigenous or the environmental, and those are factors. So there are parts of the world that are very conducive to exploration, but politically, the environment environment, or the governments are maybe anti-mining. We have Tanzania, for example, where are some promising deposits, where Barrick has a $500 million deposit that it's mining, and it's come in conflict with the government, who, after spending more than $500 million, wants a bigger piece of the pie. So that's always a problem. So miners tend to go to areas where there's security of the deposits and where there's mining, when the labor, and they can deal with on a profitable basis. So increasingly, sadly, there's a smaller and smaller area to do this.
So overall, we've got a number of factors that you believe are going to be favorable for gold going forward. We've got the falling dollar, we got rising deficits, the possible increase in inflation. But John, are these short term? And let's talk about how high, or what are the long term prospects? You know, we hit $1,900 in gold back in September of 2011. Do we ever see that price again?
Well, one thing I think that you and I, Jim, have learned over the many decades is that the gold price always surpasses its previous peak. I can recall when gold was $32 and gold went to $100 and everybody said it wasn't going to go there again. And then it went to $200 and again everybody said it wasn't going to reach that level again. At $850, everybody said that's it. And now $1,900, I believe, and this cycle, that gold will surpass the 1900 level. In fact, I've been publicly saying $2,200 is my next long-term target. But as long as our politicians have a propensity to print money, there'll be inflation. As long as they want to debase our currencies, there will be a reason to hold gold. We've had a series of bubbles, from the crypto bubbles to the stock market bubbles. All of these are lead indicators of what's ahead. So my expectation is we got much higher gold prices ahead. Unfortunately, the gold miners, there's fewer and fewer of them to play. So gold is going to be very dear indeed.
All right, John. Well, listen, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you write extensively on the precious metals market. How could they do so?
Well, they can send us either an email at maisonplasmon.com or republish my article. So there you go.
Coming up next on Financial Sense NewsHour, The Big Picture, where Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Strategist for Financial Sense Wealth Management, and Chris Sheridan have a conversation about the prospects for stock investing in the coming year and in the environment in which we find ourselves. All of that coming up next as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at FinancialSense.com. And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here. However, we are turning over the controls of the microphone for a conversation on stock investing in the year 2018 to Chris Poplava, a Chief Investment Strategist at Financial Sense Wealth Management, and Chris Sheridan. And we'll be back later.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.